Россия и Запад подошли к опасной грани противостояния, приблизив тем самым
к дальнейшему ухудшению отношений с Россией.
Прямое столкновение между Россией и Западом, вопреки их воле, может...
Соединенные Штаты заявили о возможности размещения ядерной...
Мир, в принципе, очень скоро уже может вернуться к
холодной войне. Мы сравнили доклад с пропагандой времен холодной войны.
У нас идеологических противоречий на сегодняшний день практически нет. У нас есть фундаментальные культурологические.
It's going to be a protracted conflict, and Ukraine is just the first major battle. It's going to be fought in different ways and on multiple fronts. On NATO's eastern frontier, over the countries of the former Soviet Union, in the energy market, over the airwaves, and in cyberspace. We should have no illusions. The West's conflict with Russia is not going away anytime soon, regardless of how the current standoff in Ukraine is resolved. And what is at stake is nothing short of the future of the international order. This ain't no Cold War. Russia isn't strong enough for that. But according to the Russia Challenge, a widely read and highly influential report issued by Chatham House last week, it's shaping up to be a long war. A protracted looking-glass conflict with a weakening but still very dangerous Russia. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Good to have you back. And also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, is James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And James, we'll start with you since you were one of the co-authors of this report that that inspired the theme of this week's program. First off, thank you to you and your colleagues at Chatham House for this excellent and very timely report.
Thank you.
And as I was reading this, James, I'm telling the truth here. I honestly had the feeling I was reading like a modern version of the Long Telegram or the XR. I really, not in the style by any sense, but there was this feeling that this was a sense of how coming to terms with what's going on and what should we do about it. There was a detailed account of how we got where we are, and then a sources of Putin's conduct, if you will. And then there was a what is to be done section. Now, as I said, this isn't a Cold War. Russia is not a global superpower with global reach. It doesn't lead a bloc of nations that enjoy rough parity with the West. It isn't offering a viable ideological alternative to Western liberalism. But on the other hand, Russia isn't just some minor rogue state that can be easily isolated or ignored. It has to be dealt with, and it has to be dealt with in what's become clear over the last year or so in some kind of systematic and sustained way. James, how would you characterize the conflict right now? It's not a Cold War. What is it?
Just a contextual point. In 2008, when I was still at the UK Defence Academy, I wrote a monograph which was then compared to a long telegram, and it only had a short-term impact. What's significant is that now, here we are 7 years later, you produce, of course, a larger, more substantiated, multi-authored analysis, saying a lot of things that had been said before, and now a critical mass of decision makers in Europe and the West fully get it. Mm-hmm. I think this is, I am pleasantly astonished to see that amongst circles of senior officials in most European countries, that we are talking the same language about the significance of the challenge that Russia is now posing and about its likely creation.
Oh, what a difference two wars make, one could say.
Yes, but, also what we saw for a very long time, for the better part of 20 years, is that Russia sought to address its distinctive security needs, as they have seen it, for dominance in the former Soviet space, more or less within the rules. They pushed and played with the rules, but they stayed inside sufficiently so that it was convenient for key actors in the West to ignore. the changing mood of Russia, the growth of its power, the growth of its bitterness, and at the same time, its confidence. And now what has happened in 2014 is we see that, you know, the Russians have mounted a fundamental assault on the legal basis of the post-Cold War security order. And we know it's important because the West as a whole has made over 20 years an enormous political, economic, and moral investment in this post-Cold War security system. So you have to be very short-sighted, very ignorant indeed to be indifferent to all of this or assume it is just a minor crisis that can be de-escalated and resolved within weeks or months.
Do you see it? I mean, I don't like the Cold War metaphor for the reasons I spelled out early, but we are in something now. I mean, I guess I chose to call it a long war in my introduction. I couldn't think of anything better, but it's something that requires a sustained effort. It's going to be something that is somewhat enduring. This is not a crisis that's going to go away in a year or two. It's not going to go away as long as Putin is there, and probably it could continue after he's gone. What would you? How would you characterize it?
Well, I don't know if it's important to label it, but what I would say, I think what people need to understand is if the Cold War had not existed at all, and we had this whole system of rules and understandings and networks and institutions, and Russia did exactly what it did in February 2014, the issues would be no different. Mm-hmm. So We'll find a label for it somewhere down the road.
I mean, I think you in the report, in your chapter of the report, you said you there was a couple of points in that chapter where you said at the outset, you said in February 2014, the post-Cold War international order was destroyed. In that sense, it's like August 1914. And then later you said basically it is now the West's job to defend and reestablish that order. It's almost a battle to reestablish the Cold War or to preserve the existing post-Cold War order, no?
Because if you don't, then the rest of it starts to unravel. The EU is already plagued with serious divisions. If the Baltic states perceive that we are unwilling to do everything we can short of war to uphold our commitments and our interests in Ukraine, it's perfectly reasonable then for them then to say, how confident can we be that if we face a threat from Russia, NATO will do everything by means of war, as we're meant to under the Washington Treaty of NATO, to defend us. And so you start to spread, and the Russians will help the process along. You will start to spread a deepening loss of confidence and some feelings of betrayal as well. So this is one reason why. It's not the only reason why. Everyone understands that what happens in Ukraine is very important to what happens further downstream.
And James, you mentioned that the elites are beginning to get on the same page, but I saw a disturbing poll this week about the attitudes of publics in the NATO countries.
Yes.
Of all NATO members, the only two countries that a majority would be willing to fight in the event of an attack on another NATO member. Only the United States and Canada had majorities there that were willing. And there's a problem in the publics as well as the problem seems to have been solved among the elites. But there's an issue in the publics. No,
nothing to be complacent about. But I think if you looked at similar polls taken over the past 20 years, you'd also be quite astonished at what you find. One of the weaknesses we have is we know the Western world no longer has its Adenauer, it no longer has its De Gaulle, it no longer has its Churchill, it no longer has its John Kennedy or Truman or even Nixon. We no longer have leaders who see it as one of their primary roles to explain these issues to the public, explain why they matter, and address them for all kinds of reasons, because of what's happened to communications and so on and so forth, and because of their preoccupations. And the result is that, public opinion doesn't understand a lot about this. Now, it doesn't mean that, therefore, if we face a crisis, we are going to see demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people, because if you ask the same set of people what's most important to you, foreign affairs and security policy won't come at the top of their list. Mm. If you look at those who would say foreign policy and security policy is near the top of my list, you probably wouldn't be alarmed by the opinions they
Mark, your thoughts.
Well, there's a lot to be going on with here. I mean, again, it is an excellent report, and I think it very neatly encapsulates what is, after all, an anything but neat current situation. Let me just pick up on a few things. I mean, first of all, although I appreciate on one level quite what we call it may not matter, I mean, I do want to think about this more, this notion of, well, what is it that we're in? I mean, a protracted conflict, and one that is clearly geared about more than just simply a specific piece of real estate. It's certainly not the Cold War, and not so much for reasons of just the relative strengths, but also precisely because of this issue of this sort of the ideological freighting behind it, the Russian intent and so forth. But it sounds a lot like a Cold War, in that we're talking about a long period in which actually most of the threats will not be directly military. I mean, in a way, if there is, and I don't believe there will be, but if there is going to be at some point some kind of military confrontation between Russia and, if not NATO, but some NATO member, it, in some ways it'll be like Crimea, in the sense that it's because the Russians think that the battle is already won, and the deployment of troops is really just simply to just demonstrate the truths on the ground. It's not actually going to be a contested roll in and let's see where the battlefield sort of plays. So, I mean, I think this is going to be a struggle which is precisely not going to be fought essentially on military terms, but on political terms. And this, I mean, this speaks to, for example, all the current flurry of military exercises, the Russian bomber patrols and so forth. It's not actually that the Russians are thinking, well, maybe at some point we'll spot a hole in the air defense network and we get to bomb Manchester. It's all about creating political and economic costs, grinding down European enthusiasm for defense and so forth, just as the military exercises in the Baltics, there's a constant drumbeat that you covered in your last week's podcast, was precisely about reassuring the Balts, about demonstrating red lines, though unfortunately the West has a pretty bad record with red lines, to Moscow and so forth. So anyway, this is essentially, a conflict which is going to be sublimated into political terms. And in that respect, I mean, I think it is quite a bit like the Cold War. But in a way, the early Cold War. Because we think about the Cold War, and we think about like the 1970s, where we have, you know, a Soviet gerontocracy that's quite happy with the status quo, that really doesn't want to rock the boat, that will, you know, be opportunistic wherever it can, but accepts the rules of the game. But, you know, maybe this is more like the 1950s Cold War, where actually the rules of the game are still forming, where the Russians are willing to be that much more aggressive. You know, if you think about the late 40s and early 50s, I mean, you know, these were times in which basically they were building their East European empire. And therefore, you know, it's worth, playing around with ideas, being aware that, in fact, you know, the one can lead to the other. And in a way, depending on just how long this long war is, and I don't think it's going to be a multi-decade struggle or anything like that for a moment, if nothing else, I don't think Russia can withstand the costs of this, but nonetheless, over time, new rules of the game emerge. But of course, the last thing I'd want to make is that we have to realize that this is a struggle over the international order, an international order that Moscow believes, not wholly without some truth, that is essentially one that was created by the West largely and is currently largely in the West's interests. And in that perspective, Moscow is not wholly alone. I mean, this is one of the problems for me. It's not just about what Russia is doing, but the extent to which if Russia is able to demonstrate that it can break the rules with impunity, it's not just simply a question about a challenge to NATO and NATO unity and so forth. It's also about the example that it gives to other actors around the world. And that is the second, shall I say, corrosive front that this current confrontation raises.
Could I?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Mark's points are just absolutely first rate. Let me just add my own nuances and flavors and herbal spices too, which is some of the points he mentioned. One thing I think the current conflict does have in common with the Cold War is it's intensely normative. It is ideological. We talk about values. The whole ideology of Putinism is based upon civilization. It's based upon identity. It's based upon opposing liberal postmodernism, which is caricatured as opposing gay rights. It's about some things that are far deeper than that. Let's be clear about it. So there is this normative dimension. I mean, incidentally, I think one reason why opinion in Germany has become so negative about Putin, his image in Germany has been declining and declining and declining over years, is because for the Germans, the strategic partnership with Russia was not just about business. It was a normative project. They really believe they're bringing Russia into the Western community of interests and values. So I like the early Cold War analogy that Mark is drawing. What we are missing, which you saw in the late mature Cold War, is a sense of discipline, a sense of knowing where the tacit rules of the system are, where the lines are. The Soviet Union had an existential understanding, respect for nuclear weapons. I'm not sure the current lot have this in the same way.
No, I don't.
The last Soviet leader to resort to nuclear blackmail was Khrushchev. Brezhnev did not. The current lot of people, and this is difficult for the West to grasp, are both desperate and very hungry. They feel deeply apprehensive and also extremely ambitious. And if you're Russian, these contradictions are completely normal. But, you know, the West doesn't like these contradictions. You're either the one thing or the other. So there's a different flavor to all this. Where I think it differs from the Cold War is that in the end of the Cold War, you had two hermetically sealed systems, more or less, with their own economies, with their own trading relationships. We cannot go, there's no way you can back to that. I think we've probably reached a stage at which you can, the economic sanctions have probably reached a stage beyond which they do too much damage for everybody to, you know, to get a consensus to go much further than we've gone. For this reason, because the world is too interdependent. And Mark's last point, I absolutely agree. I was aware of this on day one when I noticed how interested the Japanese were in what was taking place, and even the Saudis, because they know that other revisionist, ambitious powers are looking over everyone's shoulders and drawing conclusions. Why should the United States honor the defense treaty with Japan at its peril, or with Taiwan, if it walks away from this? And whatever the Chinese might or might not be thinking about, the Japanese worry that that's what they're thinking about.
I wanted to pick up, because we raised the issue of the civilizational struggle, James, you raised this. This is one of the points I wanted to hit on. And one of my notes to myself is, this just spin, or do they believe their own hype on this? Yeah. And one has to wonder. I mean, I put a blog post out last week where I argued that this was just ideological cover for a corrupt syndicate protecting its banal interests. I'm not sure about that. I was being deliberately provocative, but how much do they believe in this civilizational struggle, or is this just an effort to get their little sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union, and this is just a tool to do that? Or does it have to be mutually exclusive?
Well, I don't think it has to be mutually exclusive. I'm in a minority. I think these ideas have real traction. You could see their traction in Europe. I mean, you look at Le Pen's party. You look at even on the left. You look at Syriza. A whole range of groups of influence in Europe as a whole. So these ideas are serious. Now, at the same time, you can't imagine the Russian leadership wrapping themselves, these ideas around themselves like a flag, if they didn't feel they would also promote the influence and the interests of Russia. So the two are obviously related, as they are in our case. I have great difficulty with people who draw a clear distinction between Western values and Western interests. You can't do this. There might be tensions between these two things on particular occasions, but they're bound up with one another, and I think the same is the case here. And there's an internal reason as well. Part of what happened, I was an enormous critic of this in the 1990s. I was an enormous critic of Western triumphalism in the 90s. I did not like the way we set about teaching the Russians about democracy and a market economy. My colleagues at the time, as well as I, thought all of this was going to end badly, that we would simply persuade the Russians that Western models are harmful and irrelevant to them, and we would stoke a great deal of bitterness. And I just thought the 90s were a Weimar moment, if you will. And I'm not making that other parallel either.
Right.
But there is a real mood in Russia that Putin connects with. It's there. Now, of course, at the same time, they lie. They lie very well and very professionally. They were masters of turning lying into a science. They know how to do it. But that doesn't mean that these beliefs are something that they just pick up and they can just pick up one day and throw away the next.
When you look at the civilizational aspect, I mean, it has kind of two components. One component is this Ruski Mir component, that the Russian world in and outside of the Russian Federation is a distinct civilization that must be defended. That's one part of it. The other part of it is this opposition to, I mean, let's face it, beyond being against LGBT rights, I have a hard time identifying the other components of this civilization, that Europe's turned into a bunch of pansies, and we in Russia we're the real men. How do these two components link up? How do you see if this is a unified ideological superstructure, if you will? How does it hang together?
Well, if I may dare repeat what I said in that earlier monograph I wrote, what Putin has done, I think, is that he's connected pre-Soviet, Soviet, and post-Soviet values. Mm. Intellectually, you can poke all manner of holes in it, but emotionally it works in a Russian context. This emphasis on history, this emphasis on Russia's moments of greatness, this highlighting all the distinctive things about Russia that enabled Russia in the past to succeed and be respected. This is a whole narrative, okay? And the fact that we are able to subject it to sort of mind-numbing analytical deconstruction just illustrates this gap between ourselves and this, I would never call it a civilization, but this alternative normative system that works on broader principles, which are emotive and passionate. You know, Russians talk about to this day, they have revived the notion of passionarnost, which is a motivating passion in one's work, one's policy. You could see it in the way they operate, in our unpreparedness. You know, one of the great cliches, and it's true, I think, forgive me, you used it, is that Russia has limited power. But this is a state that uses its power to the full. We're not used to that. If they are committed to something, anything that can help, they pick up and they use it. And they don't play by the rules when they use it. And this constantly is unbalancing us. We don't operate like that. We're rule-governed people.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a champion boxer into a ring with a close combat specialist, he'll lose because a champion boxer plays according to a system of rules. The other guy will poke his eyes out before the whistle is blown. That's what we're dealing with.
Mark, I notice you were writing, so that tells me you have something to say here.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's just talk about the coherence, or lack thereof, but actually the coherence of the current sort of Russian ideological construct, because I think you can put the two together. I mean, the Ruski Mir, the notion that precisely there is something distinctive about Russian culture, which, if nothing else, is one of the classic post-imperial refuges. Britain's been through that. America, in due course, will go through that. You know, it's that sense of trying to hold on to what makes us us. And, you know, yes. Let's face it, all nations have the lies that they tell themselves about themselves.
Absolutely.
But the second point, I mean, I think the interesting is, really, for me, the second point is actually it's about sovereignty. It's not actually about LGBT rights. I mean, we tend to focus in on that because that is currently a sort of a particular Western fascination, and it's one of these obvious ones in which Russia demonstrates its grotesque capacities to the fullest.
And it's one of the areas where the West has I don't want to evolve. We're public opinion, and the consensus of public opinion has evolved in the West to a certain point, and it has evolved or devolved in Russia to another point. I mean, so
but very much by focusing on this, actually, what we are doing is we are demonstrating perversely how right the Russians are. In that we have now a set of values to which, I would personally fully subscribe. And we now look at the Russians and say, you have not evolved as far as we have. You have not evolved in the way we have. And that makes you backward and wrong. And in that respect, it is a microcosmic point. I mean, it actually speaks to the bigger Russian point, which is, and this is exactly where they are also tapping into the same wellsprings as movements from UKIP and Jobbik to, you know, National Front in France and so forth. It is this backlash against globalization of values, backlash against that sense. There should be anyone out there who tells you how to think, how to believe, what to do, and so forth. And I think this is what is particularly powerful and very much cohering for Putin. And very much drawing on, I mean, James was absolutely spot on about the disastrous triumphalism of the 1990s and the extent to which we would have been hard-pressed to have developed a program more comprehensively to inculcate in Russians a sense that the West is a bunch of incompetent hypocrites than the kind of policies that were adopted in the 1990s. Propping up Yeltsin and his rigged elections, encouraging the privatization of assets into oligarchs' pockets, you name it, and the massive impoverishment of ordinary Russians in the process. And so in a way, that actually becomes a case of, look, if we allow outsiders to tell us how to live and what to do, mm-hmm. we will suffer. Because they will sort of plunder our economy, steal our resources, impose alien values on us, homogenize us, Starbucks and Pizza Hutize us until there is nothing left that is Russian. And I think in this respect, yeah, of course, this is a civilizational war. This is the Russians in part saying, no, we want to do our own thing. But I think we should also be clear on the extent to which this is, it is not just Russians who are talking in terms of a civilizational war of values. I've heard it from many audiences in the West. Government as well as non-government, that says that this is actually because somehow the Russians are wrong. Somehow the Russian regime is evil. And fine, I mean, yes, of course, it is, there are all kinds of cases of abuses of human rights and so forth. But, one can also look at our great noble allies such as the Saudis, which I would not regard as a paragon of Western human rights, and we don't treat them in anything like the same way. Let's be honest. I mean, I think there is always a combination of cynical realpolitik as well as genuine ideological commitment that informs these. But the point is, the Russians are able to actually turn around and use the usual whataboutist sort of tactics, but with some grounds. Again, this does not mean that the Russians are right.
Yeah.
What this means is that we actually have to sort of acknowledge that that is what we are in. We are in a civilizational struggle on both sides.
Can I just reinforce two of Mark's points? The first is that it's a question that some of us used to ask about Marxism-Leninism. And it's this. Is it possible to separate what we today understand as liberalism, broadly speaking, from its evangelical and universalist component? That's a key question. I think in many countries around the world don't mind that we have these values, but it is the notion that they are universal values that gets under people's skin, certainly Russians. But then the second issue Mark raised parenthetically, but I think it's very important. He spoke about Western incompetence. I think part of the mixture today is that the people in the Kremlin, they not only believe that NATO is determined to weaken, destabilize Russia, that the Arab Spring was really a rehearsal for what we plan to do to them, et cetera, et cetera. But they look at our bungled and serendipitous interventions over the last 10 years, some of them very brutal, like Iraq, and they conclude we're incompetent as well. And wherever we do get our way, and wherever the rest of the world and the UN system does not stand up to us, we make a mess. So, there is a body of thinking there which you cannot just casually dismiss, even though I don't agree with it.
But does that suggest the West does have to get its own house in order to a degree to fight this conflict?
I think that we've been saying this for many years. I think Mark is one of those people who've said it. The biggest thing we can do to diminish the kind of threats we face from Russia is to get our own house in order. And you look at, coming back to the issue we were talking about 5 minutes ago, or 10, about what might or might not happen in the Baltic states. The basic cure, the basic way to prevent what we inadequately and somewhat inaccurately call hybrid war is through good governance. What happened in Crimea and eastern Ukraine happened because before the state even knew that a war had started, over a period of months, the Russians were able to become the paymasters of law enforcement in eastern Ukraine. They were able to penetrate all the structures of the state. They were able, at the last moment, when the order was given at the push of a button, to destroy all the records of the Ukrainian security services. These things do not happen in a well-governed state with institutions that are properly accountable. And staffed by highly motivated people. It doesn't happen. So if you look at problems in the Baltic states, which are not 100% dissimilar, you got to start by asking, how adequate is their counterintelligence capability? Do they have a proper career structure in their law enforcement? Are public institutions fit for purpose? If you deal with all those questions and you can then be confident the answer is yes, the Russians are going to have very few options. And you've then disposed of more than half the threat you imagine you face.
Mark.
Yeah, I mean, James is spot on. So unfortunately, you know, where's the scope for real debate when we're actually
David,
with each
David,
other.
David Johnson is not going to be happy with this podcast, say lovely.
I apologize, David. I want to pick up on that point, because I think it's really important, this notion that governance is actually the most important way of inoculating societies. I mean, again, if one looks at Crimea, it wasn't just about weeks and months. It was actually about years of mismanagement from Kiev, of neglect.
And this is a point you've made on this podcast in the past, to your credit.
But if you're a Crimean, you actually were thinking, well, Russia is, you know, if I look at Russia, people are richer and actually better governed, it seemed. And actually, I can't sort of necessarily fault them for that. No one's going to be thinking that, honestly, in Estonia. No one's going to actually be thinking, gosh, wouldn't my life be great if I was in Pskov rather than Narva? There are other issues, of course, at work. And I think this speaks to, and I know we're now kind of bleeding into the sort of topic for the second half about responses, but the extent to which in this pursuit of whatever kind of a struggle, you know, we have to be aware that this is a political struggle. This is, you know, exactly, it's a struggle of values, of unity, of will, and so forth.
It's a war of governance in many ways.
Yeah, and we tend to focus on the big, fun, clanky, heavy metal stuff, the tanks and the planes and so forth. But the extent to which actually we will win this, not just because our economies are more dynamic, which they clearly are, not just because our political systems are more inclusive, which they clearly are, but also, you know, we have the ways to both assert and protect that. And therefore, actually, one has to think about whether a euro spent on a tank is any better than a euro spent on a police officer, a counterintelligence officer, or quite possibly an integration program for a Russian speaker or whatever. But again, I think we have to consider a multi-spectrum response, and this goes back to James' thing about incompetence, about the fact that we are still, although, as it were, technically NATO is a phenomenally effective military alliance at doing military things, it finds itself in a conflict which is not a military one.
NATO people will say that, and hearing those words from a security expert is music to my ears. James Lesser, to you before you...
Very briefly, because I have to disagree with Mark about something. If in your comments about Crimea, you were implying that there is any solid basis for believing that that anything close to 90% of these people voted for inclusion, incorporation into Russia, I have to flatly disagree. The remarkable thing about Ukraine, with all, including Crimea to a lesser extent, with all the obvious dysfunctionalities that exist there and the distrust of elites that exists there, is that this whole ethnic and linguistic issue does not have roots there. It has been artificially whipped up, and everyone who has spent time there sees it. This is a state that was built by and large by Russian speakers from the East, spent 20 years there. Language has never really been an issue, except for fringe groups of people. And the parties... The parties that really believe these issues, ethnicity, language, and all the rest of it, are of fundamental importance, got about 2% in the elections last year. So not everything about Ukraine is bad.
No, not at all. I mean, and just to clarify, of course, the actual the annexation referendum was a rigged vote carried out under the gun. But on the other hand, I would say that I think that a majority of the non-Tatar population of Crimea, for the most practical reasons, rather than these emotional, political, civilizational ones, I am willing to believe that a majority, if not clearly a 90% majority, were supportive of the transfer to Russia, because precisely, I mean, they really were in a very bad state up to that point.
Out of neglect from Kyiv in a lot of ways, as well as meddling from Moscow. Well, you've provided a great segue to go into the second section where we'll talk about the recommendations in the report. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a closer look at the recommendations in the Chatham House report. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, is James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
The Russian challenge is in a way, a self-evident piece insofar as we feel that Russia is a challenge and a threat, not just to itself, but to the wider world. And this hasn't been said in such bold terms, that it's not Russia that has changed, it's the West. The West's views have evolved. Russia's have been consistent. They have been consistently anti-Western and consistently defiant.
Well, James, I see you smiling. That of course, is your colleague, James Nixey, at Chatham House, talking about this report on a YouTube video very helpfully provided by Chatham House. So I wanted the recommendations of the report: build up Ukraine as a strong, self-sustaining sovereign state, support the European ambitions of other Soviet states like Georgia and Moldova, rearm and boost NATO's credibility, systematically counter Kremlin propaganda, strip Russia of its political leverage in energy markets, and maintain sanctions. I think that's a pretty fair summary of the recommendations. Some of that was taken verbatim from the report, so I'm pretty confident of that. In a generally positive review of this report that was published in Bloomberg, the self-exiled Russian political analyst Leonid Bershitsky argued that this was not enough. And let me quote from Leonid here. He says, so their advice is essentially to wait it out. The problem with these recommendations is that they spell out essentially a passive policy that depends on Putin's passivity. In chess terms, Putin is not in a stalemate. He's in a zugzwang. I hope I pronounced that properly. He is forced to make further moves, even if they worsen his position, precisely because he must keep selling his War of Civilizations concept to Russians. He cannot afford a prolonged lull in events because he must keep his audience focused. James, your thoughts on this and on
well, first of all, let me say pro forma, though it's absolutely correct that in any report with, what did we have, 5-6 co-authors, recommendations are going to reflect a consensual view, meaning, you know, there is, I think a lot of individual authors probably had, in addition to those points, some more punchy points to make that not everyone would have accepted. So this happens inevitably when you produce a document of this kind. My own view is that we would today probably find ourselves in a different place had key Western leaders, Merkel and Obama, from the very beginning, left President Putin in no doubt that we would do everything short of war to defend and restore Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty, that we would not let them succeed in this. And then what would have been necessary, of course, is to show that we mean it. With the Russians in particular, saying it is not enough. You have to do it, because that's the sort of people they are, with good reason. So I think at some point Leonid Birshitsky is right. Nevertheless, I don't know anyone who understands the way the sanctions work and the way the Russian economy works who does not believe that within a period of years, the effects on Russia will be very substantial if this carries on. Putin understands he cannot win a long game with us as long as our unity holds and these measures stay in place. The problem is, because of that, he's very much aware of his strengths in the short term, which we are not matching. And that is why he has regularly been playing this military card in Ukraine. And despite the motivation, the talent, of Ukrainian forces, there is a clear inequality there. So I said in my own chapter, and consistently, it's not enough to restore deterrence and containment on Ukraine's western borders. We have to try to produce deterrence and containment and defense inside Ukraine itself. And the West has not been willing to take that extra step.
And you made the point in the report that the fate of Ukraine is intimately tied with the fate of the post-Cold War international order, if I'm quoting you correctly.
Yeah, and I think we need to find a way to devalue that Russian military card. I mean, after all, look at what has happened. We had the first Minsk Accord, very flawed accord. The Russians didn't just nibble away at it. In January, they mounted a full-scale assault on it and deployed in Ukraine some of their most advanced military systems and produced an absolute slaughter. What was our response? What was Angela Merkel's response? It wasn't to say, well, now we will waive our reservations to arming Ukraine. It was another Minsk Accord, worse than the first. Well, if you're Vladimir Putin, what conclusions do you draw from that? The obvious conclusion is that if this doesn't have the effect, if Ukraine is still a functioning entity, if the West is still underwriting it, if there are still not riots in the street, if Ukraine is consolidating, well, we'll have to do it again. And then we will have Minsk 3 and Minsk 4 until everyone sees sense and they give up. And that is what he's doing, and he is under pressure to do it, in my view, as quickly as possible, because the longer this goes on, the cumulative effects of the sanctions, they damage the rearmament program, they damage the energy sector, they effectively make modernization of these two critical sectors of the Russian economy impossible. That's the beauty of the sanctions, but they don't produce results quickly.
Short run, right. Mark, right, yeah, I saw you writing again, so have at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should start with a really fundamental point that for me is one of the concerns about the sort of sanctions regime. What do we want? I mean, I think this is the thing, that no measure can be assessed unless and until you know what it's actually meant to accomplish. And the point is there is no consensus. There are some who say it's basically to get the Russians to stop meddling in Ukraine. But that you accept Crimea in practice is a done deal. Or is it to actually get the Russians also to hand back Crimea, which, let's be honest, is something that politically is almost, and let alone conceptually, I think is almost impossible for Putin to grasp. Is it more generally to basically make the Russians be good boys and understand that they have to follow rules that they may not like, but nonetheless are going to be enforced by a stronger outside community? Or is it, as definitely there are some who really, you know, even if they would not say so openly, actually about regime change in Russia, mm-hmm. and that the long-term goal is to get rid of Putin and Putinism or whatever. And there are people in the West who embrace all of those, as well as people who say, why should we care about Ukraine? And until we have some sense of quite what the aim is, some consensus at least on what the aim is, it's very hard to actually sort of construct more creative, more advanced, more aggressive, whatever policies. But the second thing we haven't really agreed is, what are we willing to spend? Mm-hmm. Now, this is war, or at least a kind of war. It's on the kind of conflict spectrum. Yes, Westerners are not fighting and dying. Ukrainians are. But on the other hand, you know, we sublimate it through the fact that it, you know, economic sanctions, political pressure, and so forth. This is the nature of 21st century warfare. It's actually often not about kinetic means. But the point is, we haven't really internalized that. If we're in war, then however much we don't like it, we're willing and accept the notion that there will be body bags coming home, that there will be all kinds of ways in which we actually have to affect our domestic economy or whatever. We really want to be able to fight this on the cheap. We want to carry out certain effects, but we don't really want to have to spend on it. And if you're in Catania or Barcelona or whatever, you may well be thinking, well, we're suffering already. Why should we be suffering any more? I think it's very hard to kind of connect a sense of threat to a sense of the costs. And so I think this is I think, sort of obviously, you know, again, it sort of speaks to what James was saying earlier about will. This is, I think, in some ways, the greatest strength that the Russians have. Is precisely that, when I say the Russians, I'm talking about Putin and the handful of people who are actually determining policy. But you know, they have a focus of will. They have a sense of, at least it's a broad sense of what they want to accomplish. And just as their strategy has really been about accepting that Russia is bleeding from this conflict, but thinking that they can bleed Ukraine faster and that Ukraine has less blood to give anyway, so too, I think, in some ways, politically and economically, they know that they are bleeding from their conflict with the West. But I think they feel that they can hold on to themselves and as it were, survive the bleed long enough for the West to lose interest and so forth. So, I mean, I think, you know, the key thing is, are we comfortable with a long-term strategy which actually, you know, Putin gets to control the message that he puts out domestically? You know, actually, the Russians could pull back and, in a way, surrender the advances they've made in East Ukraine, surrender their attempts to try and bring Ukraine to their will. Obviously, they don't want to. But not actually change their attitude, not actually change their long-term aspirations. Or do we actually need to be thinking in terms of things that are actually going to be more effective more quickly at bringing some kind of response?
James, you're not only smiling, you're writing and you're smiling, which suggests you have something to say.
It's because, you know, since we're talking about recommendations, this is fun. We get a chance to say what we want. rather than analyze where the art of the possible lies. I think the goal for us, if we are serious, should be to restore and maintain the security, first and foremost, of our allies, and secondly, of our key partners, in the first instance, Ukraine, irrespective of what happens inside Russia. We are constantly obstructing ourselves by saying, well, what will be the consequences in Russia if we do this, we do that? Forgive me, that's Russia's business. Our first duty is to look after our own. And one reason I don't like the policy of regime change is that that clarity is absent from people who think about regime change. I am very skeptical that the current regime, loosely speaking, however you call it, with Putin or without Putin, is going to experience the kind of sea change that will qualitatively transform our relationship. But how Russia goes through this and works it out, and I don't think it will be a swift process, is something only Russians can influence. Every time we have got involved in this whole business of regime change, we have made a complete mess, whatever you think about the principle of it. So stay out of it. Even if you're someone like me who thinks that, as I do feel, as long as these people are in power, this is going to go on. A policy of regime change is very different. And just one swift point. There is one Russian weakness that I think we miss. We look quite rightly at the large level of support for public support for Putin in Russia. Even if it is exaggerated, it's there. What I don't think we sufficiently see is that it's volatile. I wouldn't want support like that. A lot of it is built on mythology. One reason they're afraid to commit large numbers of ethnic Russians in Ukraine is that they don't know what will happen to them if in eastern Ukraine they see Russian-speaking Ukrainians painting their houses blue and yellow and saying, get out. They had to redeploy half their forces in Czechoslovakia in 1968 because they were traumatized by what happened. So this is one vulnerability. Second vulnerability, Russians will put up with lots of sacrifice as long as they think the guys in charge know what they're doing and they're winning. Mm. And I think once Ivan Ivanovich perceives they have made a mess and Russia is losing, I think the support could disappear pretty quickly, and I think that's what Putin is worried about.
Let's pick up on this a bit, James. And you mentioned the art of the possible, and we're talking about making Ukraine a viable, strong, sovereign state. Putin clearly wants to turn Ukraine into Bosnia-Herzegovina. I've argued this on my blog and on this podcast. Can the West turn Ukraine, going to the art of the possible, into West Germany? It's lost territory, No?
Well, I said in the recommendations of my own chapter that this challenge, whatever the West does or doesn't do, this challenge is fundamentally a challenge for Ukrainians themselves. Okay? The West can do what it can to keep Ukraine in being, but only Ukrainians in the end can deliver a sustainable economy.
But they have to have the feeling that if they do this right, they can get in the EU and they can get in NATO, as a majority of Ukrainians want to be now. But as Mark pointed out in this podcast, a majority of Ukrainians might want to be in NATO. A majority of NATO doesn't want Ukraine. And you could say ditto for the EU. They have to see a reward at the end of this.
Forgive me, Brian. I think we've got past this point because... And the Russians understand this, and this is, an example of what they would call Western chytrost, our cunning duplicity, that you don't have to be a member of NATO to be closely networked into NATO, to benefit from NATO advice and assistance. You don't have to be a member of the EU to to benefit from 80% of the provisions in the ACI, the association agreement and the free trade area, will do that with all the problems and controversies surrounding them. So, if you look at today at Sweden and Finland and Austria, they're effectively integrated into NATO without even joining it. So, these These issues are manageable. What is not manageable is a situation where the leadership of a country is either unwilling or intellectually and temperamentally unable to carry out the kinds of internal reforms and changes that are needed to take advantage of all of this, and which ensures that however much money you provide, they will have to come back in 6 months' time for more. In other words, a Greek-style situation. That is not curable until you have the right people in power. The asset in Ukraine is that you do at least have a very large literate civil society that has no illusions about its leaders at all and keeps putting them under pressure. So in the long term, I personally am optimistic about Ukraine, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to provide a positive gloss over what is taking place now. Anyway, it's up to them.
It's up to them, but there's things we can do to, and it's, we're not just talking about the Ukrainians first and foremost, but we're also talking about the Georgians, and we're also talking about the Moldovans. Those are the three fronts, really, of this thing in the former Soviet space. Mark, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, first of all, the risk is that you start wandering into the realms of grand strategy that always sounds wonderful and very, very rarely actually works, because politics is usually about making the best of what happened yesterday to try and influence tomorrow. But if you go back to Ukraine first, I mean, you know, James is absolutely right that this is ultimately a struggle for the Ukrainians, and what the outside world, what the West can do is provide them with breathing space and support and so forth. Most Ukrainians, they're not interested in EU membership or NATO membership in and of itself. Absolutely. These are synecdoches. These are just how they think they will have security and a decent quality of life and decent governance and such like. So, you know, that is actually the essential thing. I mean, this is a struggle that will be won precisely through anti-corruption campaigns. Big issue in Ukraine. This is going to be a struggle that will be won through effective governance, through effective economic systems that actually will work and bring people the opportunities that they would like. All these kind of nuts and bolts things. Now, yes, of course, it's not going to be West Germany, because in part West Germany was because of the commitment of the German people post-World War II, and in part it was also because they were occupied. You had, as there another power that was basically gave them a government in a box and vast amounts of material support to rebuild and so forth. And it's an extraordinary example. We know that that's not possible, let alone likely, to happen with Ukraine. So again, we come back to this point. Yeah, the Ukrainians want to develop. They have all kind of opportunities and so forth, if only the Russians will let them. And the Russians clearly don't want to let them. So again, we come back to this thing. Well, what do we want to see in this situation? Do we care about Ukrainians living well? And if so, well, why should we care more about Ukrainians living well than Bangladeshis? Is it just because they happen to be Europeans and on our borders or whatever? Yeah. Or is it actually, as much as anything else, also about, do we care about basically making sure that Russia or a country like Russia cannot act in certain ways? I mean, the irony is that we really need to have clarity about what our goals are. If this is just about Ukraine, that's one thing. But actually, this is as much as anything else, or more than anything else, about Russia and Russia's behaviors.
James?
Well, I would not apologize for saying Ukraine is different because it's European. And even if you don't think it's fully European, it's the, you know, along with Russia, the longest eastern frontier we have. And we should make no apology for that, because we live here. And because despite the system of international law that operates, is meant to operate globally, in many respects, the wider world is still a Darwinian place. The clash of values and civilizations we're talking about with Russia is rather small change compared to some other situations you could talk about in the world. So the odds of the possible is less. Come back to an earlier point. We have invested 20 years of political economic capital in creating a secure Europe after the post-Cold War, after the Cold War, and getting Europe to work, and creating in this still semi-Hobbesian world a comparative garden. And we should not take it for granted. And if we lose it, we're going to lose much more than that.
And if we lose Ukraine, we could lose it.
If we're going to lose Ukraine, I am confident that we, in principle, that our civilization has the resources, the resilience, and adaptability to succeed regardless. But it will be the challenges ahead of us, which Mark and I both agree are already very serious, will be vastly more difficult and vastly more protracted if we get into that situation. And so we should do everything possible to make sure that we do not.
Mark, last word to you before we call it a Friday.
Well, sure. Losing Ukraine, quite what does losing Ukraine mean for a moment? But I mean, I think two points I'd make.
Ukraine means Ukraine becoming a Russian vassal state, is my understanding.
If Ukraine wants to become a Russian vassal state, we have no problem with that.
But it clearly doesn't. So losing Ukraine would be, Ukraine becoming a Russian vassal state.
But. Sure, exactly. But I mean, I think, and it will be, as it were, politically problematic. We will have allowed aggression to have its way. We will allow sovereignty to become secondary to realpolitik, but we've done that before. Again, I mean, I agree that NATO and the international order can survive that. One has to ask the question about whether or not actually a greater threat to European security actually, for example, is coming from North Africa rather than from the East. I mean, the problem is precisely to maintain this. I like this image of the garden in this unruly and Darwinian jungle. To maintain this, we have to realize that it is a constant process. It is not just something that you just do and then continues. You constantly have to, as it were, be pruning the borders and so forth. But again, I mean, I think my sort of final point I want to close with is this. We have to realize that Russia's behaviors don't just come from the fact that there's a nasty man in the Kremlin, or even there's a handful of self-interested people who believe what they're doing. I mean, I this is not a regime, I think, that would go down in the name of its ideology. They will hold on to power as their primary instinct. Doesn't mean that they don't believe in the ideology, but it just means that they are not zealots and fanatics. But it's not just because of a handful of people. It is actually because Russia feels slighted, that Russia, actually has various, I almost feel I'm putting it on the couch, various issues it's working through that it regards as being important. So I would say that I have no problem with actually the sanctions regime being maintained or indeed escalated. I mean, I think there's all kinds of other creative things that could be done. But on the other hand, the real challenge is to make this something other than a war. Because if we basically allow it to simply become this struggle of the West versus Russia, then actually we are playing into Putin's narrative. Mm-hmm. We need to find some way of admixing a thoroughly indigestible dose of kindness with the malice and brutality that, as it were, the punitive side of policy also requires.
Last thoughts, James, anything?
Statesmanship consists of looking beyond the present drama to what comes afterwards. And so Mark's final point is one I fully endorse.
All right. And that's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, has been James Scher, an associate fellow with and former head of Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. Thank to you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and fascinating discussion.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow, at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.